In 1974, a motion picture shocked the world. It has become one of the most acclaimed and successful films in history. The Exorcist is a classic in its own time. And now, Warner Brothers takes you a step beyond. Exorcist 2, The Heretic. Starring Linda Blair, Richard Burton, Louise Fletcher, Max von Sydow, James Earl Jones. Their minds locked together with the most terrifying vision of all. Exorcist 2, The Heretic.
Hello, and welcome to Unloved Sequels, the podcast that brings you a blow-by-blow critique of Hollywood's worst-rated sequels. You know, the ones that some people think should never have been made. We're your hosts. Michael, say hello.
Hello.
And I'm Claire. In this episode, we're following up one of the most iconic and critically acclaimed horror movies of all time. Sadly, neither of those things can be said about the sequel. Michael, what's the movie?
We are entering the world of bizarre nightmares, demons, flying locusts, tap dancing recitals, and sexualizing teenagers to old priests. And that's just what the director dealt with daily. This is The Exorcist 2, The Heretic.
Yay!
Ooh. So, we did not pick this movie ourselves. This film has been picked for us by one of our listeners via Facebook, Stuart. And let's have a quick listen to what he has to say and why he has told us to cover this movie.
Oh my God, what is that? Don't bring that near me. No, it can't be. It is. It's the Unloved Sequels Halloween mailbag.
Hi, Michael and Claire. I was wondering if you'd be able to cover The Exorcist 2, The Heretic, as an Unloved Sequel. I know it follows one of the biggest films to ever be released, but in my mind, The Exorcist 2 has to go down as one of the worst sequels, if not films, ever made. I watched it several times trying to convince myself that it's not as bad as I remembered, and each time it's actually turned out to be even worse. I would love to hear your thoughts and views on what made the sequel go as wrong as it did, and whether it's worth me giving it yet another go. Many thanks, Stuart from Lowestoft.
Thanks for that, Stuart. Great to hear from you, and thank you for the suggestion. So we've covered your movie. We hope you like it, and we hope all our other listeners like it as well. Michael, tell us about this film.
Okay, so The Exorcist 2 opened on June 17th, 1977, the year my brother was born. Just throwing that out there. It went on to gross $30.7 million against a budget of $14 million. It took back its budget and made a profit. But compared to the original, The Exorcist took $428.2 million against a budget of $12
million. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not quite matching up, is it?
No. So, yeah. So, adjusted for inflation, the original movie is a billion-dollar grossing movie from today's point of view.
Yeah.
But the sequel wouldn't even hit the century mark then. And if that's what the movie came out now, it would be classed as a flop, even in today's standards, even including inflation. So it's still disappointing for today. But at the time of release, Exorcist 2 was Warner Brothers' largest day and date launch, opening in 725 theaters in the United States and Canada, and set an opening weekend record for Warner Brothers with a 6.7 million, which was more than the original took, only 1.9 million in its first week in the same region. So at the end of the first week, Warner Bros. Must have been like, yeah, we got it.
No, you're not. And then all the people who'd been to see it in that first week told their friends, and no one else went to see it.
So basically, the word of mouth destroyed the performance of this movie.
Yeah.
The time, because they didn't even have previews for this, really. It kind of had test audiences that hated it, so they held it back. And when it came to doing like a launch for the press and stuff, they kind of like did it just before the opening of the movie. They didn't sometimes do it. If they're really confident with the movie, they'll do it like a week beforehand to get lots of media involvement in it. This movie didn't receive that. So in 1973, The Exorcist was the largest grossing movie worldwide. But in 1977, The Exorcist 2 only reached number 14. So Claire's favourite bit, top 10 grossing films of 1977. There will be a pop quiz coming up at the end of it, Claire, before I give you
I know the answer.
So number 10 is The Deep, based on Peter Benchley's book. A Bridge Too Far at number 9. Number 8, Oh God. Well, I don't know. Do you know Oh God? No, have I?
No.
Number 7, In the Search of Noah's Ark. Don't know that either.
No.
Some weird films. At number 6 is Goodbye Girl. Don't know. But then this is where I know the rest of the list quite well.
Okay.
At number 5, we have Smokey and the Bandit.
Uh-huh.
At number 4, we got The Spy Who Loved Me. At number 3, we have Saturday Night Fever.
Yeah.
At number 2, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. So taking that into consideration, what do you think the highest grossing movie in 1977 was? There's a linking actor in this movie, Claire.
I don't know. What was it?
Star Wars episode.
Yay!
But at the time, it was just Star Wars A New Hope, because at that time they didn't know. Or was it just Star Wars? Did they have A New Hope attached to it at that point?
I don't know. I can't remember. I wasn't there.
You weren't there, I wasn't there, and we haven't covered it on this podcast because I know that it didn't have the four in it, but who knows?
No.
So, and who's the linking actor, Claire?
I don't know. Oh, is this the pop quiz?
Well, they're both
pop quiz. Oh, I thought the Star Wars was going to be the top quiz for the pop quiz.
No, well, the part was, and then who's the linking actor that links this movie and Star Wars? Don't look at your IMDb. I see your
eyes. Oh, it's James L. Jones. Of course, it's James L. Jones. What a tit.
We had a whole conversation about him yesterday.
I was like, is Max von Sydow in this movie? I don't remember him being in Star Wars.
But he is in Star Wars A Force Awakens.
Yes.
That, isn't he? So there is another link between this film and Star Wars.
Yeah, James L. Jones. What a twat. Sorry.
Yeah, well, I think he feels like a bit of a trap because he probably went into The Exorcist 2 thinking that was a sure bet to make money.
I got two movies out this year. What could possibly go wrong?
But he probably went into it going, oh, The Exorcist 2 will make money. What's this B movie that I'm going to make on the side?
Well, this is the thing. A lot of people thought that actually about this movie. This is the follow-up to one of the biggest movies ever made. And the Star only perceived Wars. Competition in terms of release dates was this like weird sci-fi thing that no one had ever heard of.
Yeah. And then it was kind of like a B-movie with cardboard box sets and stuff. And was it 45, 50 years later, what are we still discussing, you know? 40 years.
Well, we're discussing Exorcist 2.
We are discussing Exorcist 2. So they're both right. So this movie was so badly received by critics and financially, we didn't get any more sequels to The Exorcist when The Exorcist 3 until 13 years later. So The Exorcist 3 came out in 1990. So that's for a franchise, that is a long time in the world of Hollywood. They were like, keep away from it. Keep away from it. So they felt 13 years had passed before they could make a sequel. There is also two prequels to The Exorcist. What is The Dominion and The Exorcist The Beginning. What is basically the same film, but they released The Beginning. What was the recut version of Dominion. And after The Beginning flop, they released Dominion onto home release. So this film...
It's literally the same film, just recut and re-released.
Recut, re-release, and the ending refilmed. As far as I remember.
Okay.
We should cover their movies and maybe do a versus episode. That'd be quite interesting to watch the same film with different endings and discuss that.
Yeah.
Because they both kind of underperformed, one at home release and one on, because the Warner Brothers were just like, well, we're hemorrhaging money from these Exorcist movies. None of them have been financially successful since the first one. So maybe one day we should do a versus episode with Dominion and The Beginning. Maybe the idea?
Yeah. Maybe let's take a little break
Yes, let's do
to
that.
get over this and then we'll revisit.
The Exorcist also has a TV sequel that was released in 2016 that ran for two seasons, starring Geena Davis, which ignored the sequel movies and had its own sequel thing. And now we have a further sequel, ignoring the other sequels,
We do. They're
called The
going like.
Exorcist Believer, which came out last week. So if you listen to this on release, it came out the week before this episode.
Yes.
So go and see it. Or maybe one day we'll cover that
Well,
as well.
maybe not. We don't know if it's any good because we're recording before it's come
Well,
out. But
yeah,
by the time
exactly.
we release, it will be out. So we have no idea if it's going to be any good or not. So don't go and see it on our say so.
No. Okay,
It's
so the
fine.
Rotten Tomato scores, critic score for The Exorcist 2, 9%, and the audience score is 14%. So compare that
Oh.
to the original film, what has a critic score of 86% and an audience score of 87%. Another kick
Wow.
in the pooch, that's what I have to say when they receive.
That's quite the drop off. 9% from the critics.
Yeah, they were not happy.
Jeez.
It's
Jeez.
probably even less than that because there's no critics that actually liked it, and they're probably not all loaded up to Rotten Tomato or people have inputted them. So there's probably it's probably
Yeah.
like about it's probably even less than that realistically.
Oh,
So
I
Claire,
feel bad for this film now.
I do. It's difficult sometimes when you cover this as a your podcast because then you watch so many shit movies, and when you watch something that isn't quite well messaged, you're like, people's problem. Because you're just like, oh, that's so harsh. Anyway,
Yeah.
so
Yeah.
Claire, do you have
Yeah.
any behind the scenes stuff for us?
I do. Oh, there's so much. There's so. I'm not going to go through everything because we don't have time for that. But I'll give you a little potted story of this movie. So we'll start off like we always do with our cast and creative teams. We've got a few returning cast in this movie. We've got Linda Blair back as Regan McNeil. We've got Kitty Wynn back as Sharon Spencer, and we've got Max von Sydow back as Father Merrin, even though he died in the first movie. Spoiler alert. No, we don't have to do that. People have
No.
seen it, surely. If
Well,
they've
that's
got
the
as far
whole.
as listening to this, they've seen the first one,
Yeah.
surely. In
And they've
terms
probably
of
seen
new
this one as
cast,
well, to be honest. They've probably definitely seen this one as well. If they listen to a
yes.
podcast about it, I
Let's
don't
hope so. Otherwise, this is going to be a fucking weird hour for you.
know.
New cast.
Yeah.
New cast. We've got Richard Burton in as Father Philip Lamont. We've got Louise Fletcher in as Dr. Jean Tuskin, and we've got James Earl Jones in as the older version of Kokumo. There's obviously quite an extensive supporting cast around. It's a much bigger cast. We've seen this in other sequels. It's a much bigger cast in this movie than in the original one. But in terms of sort of principal cast, ones that are integral to the story, that's our newcomers. The movie's directed by Sir John Borman, who he's got a fairly extensive CV. He also made Excalibur in 1981, Deliverance in 1972. And then on IMDb, it also lists Rospo Palenberg as an uncredited director on this movie. His only other directing credit is Cutting Class in 1989, but he also did the adaptation and screenplay for Excalibur with Sir John Borman. So they have worked together. The movie came out afterwards, but it was already in the works when this movie was being made. So they obviously had a connection already. The movie was written by William Goodhart, who also wrote A Time for Giving and Cloud Dancer. There's also, he's uncredited in the movie, but William Peter Blatty obviously wrote the original novel and screenplay for The Exorcist. So he is credited on IMDb because his characters are used in this movie, but he didn't have any writing role in this movie at all. He did come back for Exorcist 3, which I think he also directed, I think I saw when I was reading around it. But he was not, as far as I could tell, directly involved in the making of this movie. There is also on IMDb a note that Rospo Palenberg, who I just said did some uncredited directing work, also did some uncredited script work on this movie. I will explain more about how that all came to be when I get into the detail of production for the movie. The music is by Ennio Morricone, who's, it's, I think, possibly the longest CV I've ever read on IMDb in my life. Such a prolific composer for movies. He did a lot of the spaghetti westerns, The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, A Fistful of Dollars, all of those. He also did, he was composer for La Cage aux Folles in 1978. But yeah, he has done so much.
I love the music in this movie. It's completely off the wall and bonkers. You know,
yes.
I just think he did a great job. And I think it's one of the sound mix on this film is one of the highlights.
I agree. And I think they had to get someone big in to do the music for this movie because of that iconic music from the first movie. That use of Tubular Bells in the first movie is so iconic. They had to have someone really big and someone who really was up to the job to do the music on this because it's such a big thing to follow. And yeah, I agree. I think the music on this movie is great.
Yes.
Moving on to production of the movie. So the original cast and crew of The Exorcist were dead set against having a sequel for this movie. There was a point where William Friedkin and William Peter Blatty, William Friedkin was the director of The Exorcist and William Peter Blatty, the writer. They did meet to discuss ideas at one point, but they couldn't come up with a premise between them. And so they abandoned the idea of doing a sequel. We now know that William Peter Blatty went on to write a second Exorcist novel, which was then adapted into the third movie. But the novel didn't come out till 1983.
Yes.
So at this point in time, that novel didn't exist. He hadn't got, I suppose he maybe didn't even have the idea at this point. So there was no concept for them to make a sequel to the movie. So John Boorman had originally been offered the chance to direct the first movie, The Exorcist, which he declined at the time. He didn't like the script. He didn't connect with the material at all. But when he was reapproached to do this, he agreed to make this movie in order to get Excalibur made in a way that we've heard before. We get people going, okay, well, I'll do this, but only if you also finance this movie for me. I really want to get this film made. So that's how that came to be. Both Linda Blair and Ellen Burstyn turned down repeated offers from the studio. They kept being approached. They kept saying, no, we don't want to do it. Although Blair did eventually relent on that and agreed to come back into the sequel once they had presented her with a script that she was happy with. She did agree on condition that she would have to do no extensive makeup work because she found it too much from the first movie. So all of those flashback scenes where we see Regan possessed as a youngster, that's all done by a double. She doesn't do any of that stuff because it was in her contract. She wouldn't do any of that kind of heavy makeup work. There were quite a lot of rewrites, though, as the movie went through production. So by the time they'd actually came to making the movie, Linda Blair was no longer happy with the script, but was committed to do it. So she couldn't back out of the movie because she was contractually obliged. By all accounts, it sounds like it was a pretty troubled production overall. Like I said, Ellen Burstyn didn't want to be in the movie. She's never gone on the record to say why, but it sounds like the first movie was quite a traumatic for everyone involved in terms of the production process. I think the director was quite aggressive in a lot of his methods. There was a point where he fired a pistol right next to the head of, I can't remember the name of the actor that played Father Callas. Right. In order to get a reaction from him, which apparently he absolutely lost his shit at. He was like, well, I'm an actor. If you want me to act like I'm unnerved, tell me to act like I'm unnerved. Don't fire a bloody pistol next to me. And obviously it's a prop pistol. He didn't actually set off a proper firearm. Like, it was a prop gun, but still it was. So there were some fairly aggressive methods used, I think, in making the first movie. And also it is quite well known that Ellen Burstyn sustained quite a serious injury in the making of The Exorcist. In the scene where she gets flung off Regan's bed to the wall, she fractured her coccyx and has been left with permanent spinal damage. So you can kind of understand her going, I'm not sure I want to revisit that world. So she declined. But she is now. So I'm going to do a little sidebar here before I carry on talking about The Exorcist 2, a little wee sidebar about her involvement in this new upcoming Legacy sequel. So she said, you know, what happened was I've turned down so many versions of The Exorcist 2. I've said no every time. This time they offered me a whole bunch of money and I still said no. And then they came back and said, we doubled the offer. And I said, okay, let me think about it. The next thought that came to mind was, I feel like the devil is asking my price. And the next thought that came to my mind was, my price is a scholarship program for talented students at Pace University. That's my price. So then I went back and upped their offer and ended up getting what I want. And I've got a scholarship program for young actors. That was her leverage. On the other hand, the director of the new legacy sequel, David Gordon Green, said, "It's incredible. I read her biography and then it became like a mission. Could I invite one of the Hollywood icons to step into this role that she hasn't been in 50 years? That's a true undertaking. The inspiration that her book gave me in terms of her perspective after the movie and how the success of the movie, I say success, but also a lot of obstacles and hardships were faced because of the notoriety of the film. So I got to know her and we swapped literature and ideas and we evolved this character to be meaningful for Ellen beyond just a Chris McNeil revisit." Mm-hmm. So he makes it sound a little bit more fluffy and lovely and Hollywood. "Oh, I worked with her and I appealed to her better nature." And she's like, "I wanted more money and I wanted a scholarship program." So probably somewhere between those two versions of the story is what actually happened. But yes, so we've got her back in the new sequels, but she in the 70s was definitely not interested in being in The Exorcist 2. So what they did was they cast Louise Fletcher, who, as I already mentioned, played the doctor in the movie in the final cut. But at this point, they cast her to play Chris McNeil. They recast the character because Louise Fletcher looked quite a lot like Ellen Burstyn. I did find it a bit confusing at the beginning of the movie because I was like, that really looks like her mum, but I don't think it is. And the character clearly is. And it took me a while to work out what was going on. And then there was also the thing of it bugged me for half the movie of why do I recognise her? And then I realised it was Nurse Ratched from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yes.
Which I don't think she was. No, she had already made One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, I think.
Yeah, she was younger than
that. I can't remember the order of the movies. Yeah. Anyway, so Louise Fletcher was cast as Chris McNeil, as Regan's mum, because Ellen Burstyn didn't want to come back. And then they couldn't find an actor to play Dr. Tuskin, which also explains why Gene Tuskin's name was spelled the male way, which I also found confusing in the movie. Yeah. That her name badge spelled Gene, G-E-N-E, because that part was originally written for a man. And clearly when they changed the actor, they didn't change the spelling of the name. They couldn't find someone to play the role of the doctor. So they moved Louise Fletcher into that role and then brought back Kitty Wynn to play Sharon, who had been Chris's sort of PA, sort of faux guardian for Regan. So she came in to play that role, but as the character she had been in the original movie, rather than recasting her. That would have been weird.
Yeah.
So they brought that character in to fill that mother role in the movie. Kitty Wynn was actually quite hesitant to come back. Originally, the script had quite a big role for Lieutenant Kinderman, who was played by Lee J. Cobbs in the original movie. He was supposed to feature quite heavily in the sequel, but the actor had died in the interim period, so they reworked the film and removed that character. But then that character does appear, with a different actor, of course, in The Exorcist 3, because the character features in the novel Legion, which is the novel that was adapted into that. In terms of the actors, Richard Burton has very openly admitted in interviews that this was a paycheck movie for him. He was on the way towards one of his divorces from Elizabeth Taylor. I'm not quite sure which one. I don't know the timeline of their relationship particularly well. But he knew that the divorce was coming and he needed money for that. And again, he played the same card as the director. He agreed to make this film in return for being cast in Equus, the movie that was made in the same year. He played that role on stage. It was the role of Dr. Martin Dysart. I don't know how you say the name. He played the role on stage and he wanted the role in the movie and he knew the movie was being made. So he said, "Well, I'll do this if you let me also do that." Now, apparently, according to Linda Blair, at the start of production, Richard Burton was sober. By the end of production, he was very much not sober. He was getting drunk during filming. And in fairness, Linda Blair was not sober during production of this movie either. Her drugs issues had already begun at this stage. So both of them were not at the peak of their potential, let's say. And so tensions were quite high among the cast. Apparently, Richard Burton was reading off cue cards for quite a lot of scenes. Possibly if he wasn't sober, that might have been the reason. There was a in the original script, the scene towards the end where Pazuzu manifests as, I'm going to call her Evil Reagan, the evil twin kind of version of Reagan, and tries to seduce the priest. In the original script, that scene was supposed to be a lot more intense. She was supposed to lure him over, and to the point that he would rape her in the scene, or he would rape the manifestation, which would then trigger off his kind of self-destructive path. Which was the, you know, which is what Pazuzu wanted. But neither of the actors was comfortable filming that. So it got reworked.
Well, she was only 16 when she filmed this, wasn't she?
She was 17. So the character was 16. But she was 17, but he was 52. It's a bit
creepy.
It's a bit ick. And actually, even when they cut it down to what we see in the movie, they were still both really uncomfortable with it because of the age difference. And because, you know, he was married to Elizabeth Taylor, for God's sake. That's going to be a bit weird from Linda Blair's point of view. But also, you know, they built up a relationship across filming, although she did say that tensions were quite high between the cast during production. They had built a relationship, and it was a very sort of fatherly, daughterly one, both on screen and in real life. And so making that scene was very uncomfortable, I think, for both of them.
Yeah, well, I think the director was probably just looking for that controversial scene, like the crucifix stuff in the first film.
Meanwhile, the production was being refused permission to film at just about every location they asked for, including the house from the first film. So they wanted to go back there. They were told they couldn't. They had to recreate everything within studio backlot, which is what pushed the budget. Originally, the budget was $9 million. The extra $5 million to take it up to $14 million was having to recreate so much of what they wanted for the sets and the locations. Yeah. And particularly, obviously, they had to recreate the house from the first movie, and it had to be a good replica. So that kind of helped to inflate the budget. So let's talk about Roscoe Pallenberg. I mentioned him when I was going through the cast and creatives, and it seemed a bit weird that he was somehow uncredited as director and also uncredited as writer. So how that came to be is, so John Boorman was not happy with William Goodhart's script, asked Goodhart to do a rewrite and bring in some ideas from Roscoe Pallenberg, who, as I mentioned, he was already working on Excalibur with.
Yeah.
Goodhart refused to do that. So they just went ahead and rewrote the script anyway. So Boorman and Pallenberg rewrote the script together. It was constantly being rewritten all the way through production, which is how we kind of got to the point of Linda Blair having been originally very happy with the script. By the time they were shooting, she was less happy. But then as they were filming, they did go over and do some location work in Africa. And while they were doing that, Sir John Boorman picked up a fairly serious lung infection, which took him out of production for a month. So Roscoe Pallenberg, who had never directed before, and like I said, has directed one movie since, basically stepped in as director rather than halt production while John Boorman recovered. Roscoe Pallenberg, who'd been brought in as a kind of script advisor and doing script rewrites, just stepped in and took over directing while John Boorman wasn't around. So that's how he ended up doing that uncredited work in both areas. It's a bit weird, but that's how it ended up. Now, as you mentioned, the film was not very well received in theatres. So William Friedkin, who directed the first film, told a story. He kind of recounted this story at the Chicago Critics Film Festival in April 2013, that studio heads had come to the preview of Exorcist 2. They'd all come in a limo. They'd sent their drivers off to go and get some food for them for later. They sat and watched the movie. And about 10 minutes into the film, an audience member stood up, looked around the room and shouted, "The people who made this piece of shit are in this room." And about 10 other people from the audience basically searched the room to find these studio executives and started to kind of mob them. The executives tried to do a runner. I mean, this is the story being told by the director of the first movie. I'm not sure he was there, but this is the story he tells. They tried to sort of make a run for it, and their cars were not there because they'd sent them off to get food. They couldn't escape. So they ended up getting chased down the street by this angry mob at the previews.
If you can decide within 10 minutes of a movie that this movie is a piece of shit and somebody's going to stamp it, chase you out of a movie screen, then those people should be in test screenings. Because
I think it takes longer than 10 minutes of this movie to work out whether you like it or not as well, having seen
100%. It. 100%. You don't know what's going
on. Despite that little story, that is basically a version of what happened. When people started watching this movie, audiences were furious. People were apparently, there was a theatre in Hollywood Boulevard where people were apparently throwing things at the screen because they thought it was so bad. What William Peter Blatty, who was the writer of the novel, supposedly was having to stifle his own laughter at the premiere watching it. Anyway, whatever really happened, I don't know. But I do know that Sir John Borman pulled the film out of theatres twice to do further edits because it had been so poorly received.
Yeah.
So there's a few versions of the movie that exists. It sounds like, I think we both watched slightly different versions of the movie. Yeah. So in these edits, he shortened some of the scenes, he swapped some of the scenes around, took out some dialogue. He added an introduction with narration by Richard Burton, which I think I saw. I certainly, the beginning sequence was certainly narrated by Richard Burton because it made me think of Jeff Wayne. What's the guy's name that did War of the Worlds? You don't know because I went to see it with your husband.
That was Liam.
You had
Nielsen.
No interest in going to see it. Yes, I know that was Liam Neeson. So, but in the original recording, the part that was played by Liam Neeson when we went to see it, when I went to see it with David, Richard Burton did that part originally.
Okay.
So on the recording that I listened to at home, it's Richard Burton's voice.
Why would you listen to a recording of that? Why?
Because I love it. I love it. I love it. And Richard Burton's voice is amazing.
Nathaniel, whatever it goes to, David sings
that's that. Really not the best bit of the soundtrack at all. It's just the bit that your husband likes because Kerry Ellis sings it. Anyway, we digress.
Yes, we do.
How did we exorcist Kerry Ellis? Anyway, so we had this introduction with narration by Richard Burton. He also changed the ending, which is where we've definitely seen different versions.
Yes.
Because you saw the ending, which I think was the latest version of the ending, where the movie ends after Reagan comes out of the house. You see Father Lamont fall through the floor and Reagan comes out, cut to black, end movie.
Yes.
Now, in the version that I watched, after that, you see the doctor holding Sharon, who had set fire to herself earlier in the movie. She's very badly burned. There's a conversation between Sharon and Reagan, so you know she's still alive at this point. And then the priest comes over and prays over her, presumably giving her last rites, and then she dies.
Yes.
So in the ending that you saw, there is the suggestion that the priest has died because you don't see him emerge from the house, but then Sharon's fate is left ambiguous. Open. Whereas in the version I saw, it's very clear that he survives. It's very clear that she dies.
Mm-hmm.
But to be fair, we're kind of splitting hairs because that's such a small factor of the overall.
Yeah,
film.
No.
He didn't change anything significant in the film.
Yeah, well, the one I watched was a home VHS cut of the film, what they released onto VHS when it got home release later on.
Right.
But I have seen the theatrical cut many, many times. Just that most recent one I watched. But I Googled it and I said which one was the best to watch. And a lot of people think the home cut is better because it trims off some of the wackiness of it. So,
yes. I think it would lose something for not having that ending. That ending does sound a bit ambiguous that you saw. Like when we were talking about it, I don't know if it was yesterday or the day before, and we were talking about the end, and I was like, but it's really clear what happened at the end. And you said, but no, it's not, because we'd seen different endings of the movie.
Yeah.
So anyway, in 2005, Sir John Borman said, it all comes down to audience expectations. The film that I made, I saw as a kind of riposte to the ugliness and darkness of The Exorcist. I wanted a film about journeys that was positive, about good, essentially. And I think the audiences, in hindsight, were right. I denied them what they wanted and they were pissed off about it, quite rightly. I knew I wasn't giving them what they wanted and it was a really foolish choice.
Well, yeah, that's what comes down to this end of this movie is they went into it thinking the highlight of the original movie was that toss up between science and religion. So that's what they focused on the sequel with, when the audience just wanted another girl being possessed.
Exactly. Yes, so, that's the issue. Know. So you think he still stands by the movie? It was the movie that he wanted to make, but he clearly didn't factor in what the audience wanted. And that's why it was so poorly received, I think. But before we talk too much about that aspect of things,
yes,
Were there things in this movie that you did like?
Yeah, well, let me take you back on a journey. Back to... So when The Exorcist came out in 1973, in the UK, the party in power, the Conservatives, really wanted to ban The Exorcist. They didn't like it. It was very religious, horror-focused. But because of the way the BBFC, the British Board of Film Classifications, works in the UK, when you have a rating of an 18, it means that only people of 18 can go and see that. But they were reacting to how the film had been received in America when it was an R. And if a film is an R in America, it means that anybody can go and watch it as long as you're accompanied by somebody who is of that age. So it's a bit like how 12A works in the UK. Is that right? Yeah, that's right, isn't it?
Yes. So theoretically, I could take my two kids who are 5 and 8 to see an R-rated movie if I wanted to. So in this country, I could not take my children to see a movie like that because it's an 18 certificate and you cannot enter the room. At the movie theatre, legally, you can't enter the room if you are under the age of 18. And that's the difference between here and America.
Yeah. So when the party in power decided to push to ban the original movie, the BBFC said, no, it's okay. It's an 18 rated movie. No children can see it.
Yeah.
When the movie came out for home release in the 80s and the Conservative Party that was still in power then, which was 1988, I think that was Thatcher's years. Was Thatcher's years? I think.
Yeah, Thatcher was around till 90.
Yeah. She managed to get and push for the BBFC to ban The Exorcist on home video within the UK because they felt that because the content was entering people's homes, they couldn't monitor if children were watching the movie away from their parents because their content was available to them. So after a few years of it being on rental and on home release, the BBFC did ban the original movie, and it was banned for a really long time until 1998. So it was banned for 10 years. So when I was growing up, I had no access to see The Exorcist because it wasn't available to rent around. I didn't know anybody that had a copy before the ban happened because they removed all the copies from the shelves in January 1988 when the law took effect. So I didn't see The Exorcist until 1998, what was its 25th anniversary, and they lifted the ban.
Yeah.
So I actually saw The Exorcist 2 before I saw The Exorcist because that was so widely available.
Yeah.
So, and I was a big film geek then, and I used to read up on books about The Exorcist being banned. So when I went to Blockbusters, VidBiz, whatever it was at the time, I saw The Exorcist 2 and I rented it because I was like, why is the first one banned? I need to watch the sequel. So my first taste of The Exorcist in my mouth was this movie.
In your mouth. Was the first taste of it in your mouth was the vomit that came up when you watched The Exorcist 2.
And when I was younger, I didn't hate this movie. I didn't hate it. I actually really liked it. Because I felt like I was watching something that was quite controversial, you know, as a film fan. And watching like the flashback scenes that obviously have been refilmed for this film, like that bit with the heart and stuff, I thought it was awesome. I was like, I'm getting an insight into something that I wasn't supposed to see. Like, things I really liked about this movie, like I said before, I really like the sound mix. I like the way it's quite loud and quite threatening and quite jumpy. Mm-hmm. It makes you feel extremely uncomfortable at times. And I love that for it. I do like the fact it makes that it does heighten from what the Tubular Bells did. I felt like it kind of like takes you on a journey with it. And makes you feel uncomfortable in your seat, what is great. I like some of the wacky stuff in it. I really like the wacky bizarre nightmares, and I quite like the tap dancing scene. Do you want to discuss the tap dancing scene? Because a lot of people have an issue with the tap dancing scene.
They have an issue with it.
Massive issue with it. Like, why is it in there? Why is it in there? Why is she tap dancing? And I just think people don't realise that it's probably put in there to try to keep Reagan's innocence.
Yeah.
Because
for me, when I watched it, it seemed to me they were showing that she'd grown up a little bit because they show her having that little visual exchange with the boy with the saxophone or whatever he was playing. Yeah. So you see that she's kind of matured a little bit and she's a teenager. It's a very teenagery thing to do, isn't it? To be in the school show. I presume it was the school show that she was being
recital,
in. And it's a very wholesome activity to be doing tap dancing. And it was an indication that she had moved on to having some sort of normal life.
Yeah.
Because my perception is, you know, that it's a very normal thing for a teenage girl in America to do, to be in the tap show.
Yeah.
Maybe that is not as normal as I think it is. But to me, it signified that she had got some kind of normality going on and that she was a teenager.
Yeah.
Because actually you could, without that placement of giving an age to her. I mean, you know, the passage of time since the first movie, but it would be very easy to forget that she's only 16, the character in this movie.
Yeah, because if you look at how Linda Blair has performed in the movie, her top, she's wearing a quite low cutting. She has developed woman-wise. She's got curves on her. She's really pretty. She's got makeup on. Her hair is done. And she's that age. If they didn't show some form of innocence for the character, you would think that she's an adult. What would take you out of the whole how, if they did do the rape scene with the priest, or even like him getting on the bed and snogging her, if they didn't have that innocence about the character, you would think nothing of it. You wouldn't find it as disturbing. And that was supposed to be the disturbing scene in this movie as much.
And you see her wearing white through so much of the movie as well.
Yeah.
All part of that kind of
trying to keep her
positioning
innocent.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think a lot of horror fans that did watch it felt it took it away from them. Why is she tap dancing? Why do we need this? And for me, it was obvious. It was just about innocence and keeping her young.
I mean, I know that Linda Blair at the time was a bit like, why am I tap dancing? This is weird. But for me as a viewer, it didn't seem weird at all.
Apart from that, you know, I don't dislike the storyline in it. I don't mind them delving into the focusing on the science versus religion. We had a conversation off camera beforehand about how, I suppose it's kind of like where you sit with religion, really, because a lot of the device in it, what do they call the device again, Claire? You're going to forget because I'm going to forget.
Synchronizer,
that's it. Synchronizer. A lot of people are like that.
Two light bulbs on a stick.
But a lot of people are like, that's so unrealistic. But for me, I'm not a religious person, so the idea of demon possession is probably just as unrealistic as the synchronizer is.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of people kind of like get lost in translation with that. I suppose if you're really heavily religious and you believe in heaven and hell, then the having demons and being possessed is probably not unrealistic to you. But for me, they're both quite unrealistic. So if I'm going to fall for what's happening in the first movie, I'm quite happy to long to go with what's happening in the sequel with the synchronizer and being like mentally connected. What did you like about the movie?
I agree with everything you just said. I think the performances for the most part are very good. I think Linda Blair makes the transition from child actor into being a teenage young adult actor very well. She has a lot more to do in this movie because, of course, a lot of the stuff that she was acclaimed for at the time in the first movie, I think she was Oscar nominated, wasn't she? Best Supporting Actress for the first movie.
Correct.
And this was before the world knew that actually she hadn't done a lot of the performance. Her voice when she was possessed was dubbed. And obviously there was a lot of stunt work. There was a contortionist for the spider stair scene. So a lot of what we see of Reagan in the first movie isn't necessarily Linda Blair, which is not to take away from her performance in that movie.
The original cut of the movie didn't have the spider scene in it.
It didn't have. No, I realised this. It didn't have the spider scene in. As I was saying it, I was thinking actually that it wasn't in there. But nonetheless, in this movie, she does a lot more as an actor. And she does it well. I think Richard Burton, Richard Burton is cheese on toast in this movie. It's full on Welsh rare bit.
He's a different era of actor, though. He's a very different.
He is. And he was very well known at this. Yes. Like, if you hire Richard Burton, you know what you're getting. So we have to assume that what we got from Richard Burton is kind of what they wanted for the movie. Because why else would you hire Richard Burton?
I don't think he's that bad in it, apart from when he's trying to put the flame out with the broom and he's kind of like just swinging it around.
Yeah. I think for a lot of the movie, he's very good. There are some very, very hammy moments, but it's, you know, he is from an age of very, very hammy British acting. So if you're going to hire him, that's what you're going to get. I think all of the cast were good. I liked the little interactions. She had a couple of interactions, didn't she, with younger cast members, Linda Blair, I mean.
Yes.
I like those little moments.
How did you feel about the use of autism within the film?
Well, I had mixed feelings. I mean, let's first up, neither of us are experts on autism.
No.
But I liked that they even used the word autism in a film in 1977. I was not aware that autism was, and I'm going to use inverted commas with my fingers, a thing in the 70s. I wasn't aware that diagnoses were common enough in the 70s for it to be something that they would mention in a movie in that way. So mm-hmm. I thought that was really good. I liked, as I say, that little moment of connection between the girl and with Reagan. The thing I didn't like in that scene was that she, again, in inverted commas, cured the girl's autism. I had thought watching the scene that it was a psychic conversation, that although we saw the girl's lips moving, I didn't perceive it as her speaking out loud. I thought they were talking to one another psychically. So when the mum entered the room and she continued to speak, that seemed, and then, you know, and everyone's reaction was she's cured, was a bit like, that's not really how autism works. No. But the fact they are recognising autism as a condition in a movie in the 70s, I thought was very progressive, actually.
I thought that,
particularly with it being a girl as well, because autism is massively underdiagnosed in girls.
Yeah. I think with the storyline, the way they, it was kind of the way you look at the scene, you think they're talking to each other in the head. But I think in the long run, I think the reason why they chose to say, like, cure her was because it wraps up that sub character storyline.
Yes.
Because you, if you just talked to her in her head and then that's where the character ended, you would go walk away leaving, thinking, oh, what happened to that little girl? Did she ever get cured?
And I'm sure they didn't spend very long researching autism for this section of the movie. Like, you know what I mean? This is such a small section in the scheme of things.
You say that. Well, I watched just behind the scenes clip on YouTube. Maybe we'll share it on our socials. But it was filmed and it wasn't for TV use. I don't know what they use it for. It says above it in bold capitals, not for TV use. It's actually talking about the behind the scenes, and they had loads of experts on that really believe that telepathically you could talk to each other by your own minds and be connected. And it had loads of people that were like, they're like hypnotizing people. And they're showing this in this clip, and these experts were on the film. So they're probably convincing the director this is all true. Just probably the way they had loads of religious experts on the first movie.
Yes. And they could well have been a whole bunch of charlatans for all we know.
Exactly.
So,
so
maybe they thought they had done a lot of research and that, okay, fair enough.
Yeah. So, well, maybe I'll send that over to you, but I think maybe we'll share that because I think it gives you a good insight about why they chose to go down this road in this movie. This movie, I don't want to say this out loudly, but I do think this movie was trying to be cleverer than the audience that was watching it. Is that the wrong thing to say?
Yes, I know what you mean. You're not trying to be insulting to the audience at all.
No.
I think, it's cleverer than people would have been expecting from this movie based on the original.
Yes.
And therefore, no one will have gone into it with the mindset for a movie like this, which is why 100%. They came out thinking it was a bunch of trippy shit.
Yes. And it is a bunch of trippy shit, but I enjoyed the trippy shit. Yeah.
Yes. So in trippy shit then, let's talk about that aspect of it. What didn't you enjoy so much?
It's difficult because when you watch it, the story's so disjointed that you take your eyes off the screen for more than a minute and you're just like, what the fuck is happening? What the fuck is happening? Why am I supposed to be flying on the back of a locust to Africa all of a sudden?
Yeah.
And why
that's
is
exactly what Earl I've
Jones
written down.
Is kind of like wearing a locust suit and then next minute he's in a lab. I'm just like, what the fuck is happening?
Yeah, I was paying attention at that point and I still got a bit confused.
Yeah, it's, do you know what? If Stanley Kubrick made the fucked up movie and made Exorcist 2, I think people would have seen it as a work of art because they expect fucked up movies from Stanley Kubrick. You know, I think going into it, it's a weird movie.
You know, Kubrick was approached to make this movie and he declined.
That would have been a good movie.
Yeah, he was offered it.
I think
it'd
be more widely received because I think people went into it expecting, if people went into it, Stanley Kubrick's Exorcist 2, I think people would have been like, this is going to be really fucking trippy. And they would have got a trippy movie.
Yeah.
And, I think that, look, I have watched this film multiple times. I've seen different cuts of it. And I really sometimes hope, like Stuart, to talk to us about it, how he hopes every time he watches it, it gets a little bit better.
And does it? I've only seen it once, so I don't know.
No, it doesn't. It gets a little bit more. It gets a little bit more trippy. Even though you're expecting it, like the bloke falling down the cliffs and he's hitting the sides as he goes. Well,
yeah.
It's like, it is trippy. It is really trippy because I also get really lost in the aspect that this priest is assigned this job to go and find out how that other priest had a heart attack and died in the room with the little girl. And then he finds that in the first 30 minutes of it, and then we're on another trip altogether.
And then we still got another hour and a half of movie.
Yeah.
That he has to go to Africa and talk to Darth Vader.
Yeah, I'm a bit kind of like, what's going on? Yeah, the storyline isn't streamlined enough. It's trying to be too complicated for its own good.
Yes.
The trippy stuff and about Pazuzu. Pazuzu? Pazuzu?
Pazuzu.
Pazuzu. I don't mind all that. It doesn't bother me. I quite like the African roots about it. I quite like those scenes with the locusts, though I do find it weird at the end when Reagan starts mimicking the collecting of the locusts to stop them flying around and affecting the crops, but there's no crops there. It's very weird.
But then how else was she going to stop them? What else could they have done to end the movie? Otherwise, we'd still be here 40 years later.
Well, I would have got buzzing out around the fucking house. Well, yeah, that's the whole thing. How did what did the priest do to stop evil Reagan?
He ripped out her heart.
Yeah, but how would that? We didn't know. Oh, I suppose at the beginning he said you need to rip out
your
heart. So
that so then
yeah, that's true.
So it's a bit to me, and this is my interpretation of it. And I can't remember the name of the movie. There's a Denzel Washington movie that no one has seen, I think, apart from me. Hopefully you. I must have made you watch it. Where there's a demon that can pass from person to person. I think it's through touch. And they start singing Rolling Stones' Time Is On My Side. Time is on my side.
Oh, I know
that. And that's how you
is.
Know that they've got the demon in them. Can't remember what the movie's called. But that felt to me like that. So the spirit had to go somewhere. So Pazuzu was in this manifestation of Reagan. The priest rips out the heart from the manifestation. The spirit has to go somewhere, and so it takes the form of the locusts. And so Reagan then does the ceremony, whipping her hand around to tame the locusts in order to defeat the spirit. Fallen, yes. Love that movie.
It's a very good
movie. Love that movie. It is a good movie.
I get confused with that and the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, End of Days. I think they kind of like came out nearly at the same time. It was about demon possession as well. But
yes. But that felt to me a little bit like that the spirit had to go somewhere. Pazuzu had to go somewhere, so he took the form of the locusts, and so she has to tame the locusts. That's my
so she tamed the locusts.
Read of that, yes.
And he ripped out her heart, and this combined effort killed Pazuzu.
I don't know if it killed Pazuzu or if it contained him or if it banished him. Or I have no idea. They don't really explain.
Because
I guess they're leaving it open in case they want to make another sequel. He's got to be able to come back.
Well, in number three, they don't even tackle Reagan in.
No, well, yes. But when they were making this movie, they didn't realise that it was going to be ignored for subsequent sequels.
Yeah. Well, I think, obviously, the Pazuzu is back in The Exorcist Believer. And he takes on the form with those two girls. But I don't think they're going to take into consideration what happens in The Exorcist 2. I think they're going to do that whole Halloween thing where it kind of like just focuses on the first movie and it's going to jump to the new legacy sequels.
Yes.
My other issue with this movie is there's too many cooks. When you start researching about the production and the rewriting of the script and what the studio wanted and what the director wanted and what the cast wanted and what the audience wanted, too many people wanted a different end result for this movie.
Yes.
And that's a problem. I also thought that obviously once again, we're in that situation. Our modern day technology has caught up to what the director didn't expect. You wouldn't expect to in 1976 when this was being filmed, that you would be able to watch The Exorcist and The Exorcist 2 back to back.
Yes.
At home at any time. They didn't have that ability. So we didn't have VHSs, we didn't have access to media that we have today. So the director probably wouldn't take into consideration that when you watch The Exorcist, then watch The Exorcist 2. The special effects, the cutback scenes, they're very, very disjointed. You look at Evil Reagan in the original movie, and then you watch Evil Reagan in this movie, and they're played by very, very different people. Yeah. They have very, very different feel and touch to it. Taking that into consideration, you know, we are where we are. Claire, what didn't like about it?
So again, I agree with everything you just said, almost like we discussed before recording.
Maybe.
The thing, besides everything you've talked about, the thing that really stuck out for me was the mother being missing. Yeah. She felt missing from the movie. Obviously, I know the story of how that came to be and that Ellen Burstyn didn't want to be in the movie. Yeah. And that they tried to recast it. And maybe it would have worked better if they had just recast and let that character be the mother rather than being Sharon. Yeah. But it just, there were
especially
so many
the
points.
Connection in the first movie, the how much the mother's involved with Reagan in the first film.
Yeah, there are so many points that you just think that this is the point where you'd say, and let's call her mum.
Yes.
Like, it's the 70s. It's not like now where the mum's going to suddenly appear on the doorstep the next day because you can get from A to B in 2 hours.
Yeah.
You know, just a thing of your mum's on her way. She's not going to be here before the end of the movie because it takes a day and a half to travel from wherever she is. Yeah. But there was, other than that very brief explanation of, oh, she's away filming at the beginning of the movie, she's never mentioned again. Like, no. Even at the end, in the ending that I see, where she, the doctor says to the priest, you better go, take Reagan with you. I think she says, look after her or something. There's no, like, and call her mum.
Yeah.
Or take her to her mum, take her home. There's nothing like that. It's like the mum, it doesn't exist anymore because she's not been written into the script. And that, she felt missing to me. Maybe that's just because I'm watching as a mother and I watched it so soon after watching the first movie. And as you say, that bond between mother and child is so strong in the first movie that it felt very missing to me in the second.
Yes. Do you think, because we don't know what's happening in The Exorcist Believer, the new legacy, Linda Blair doesn't want to be in it, apparently, but she was called onto set to make sure the kids were treated in the right manner, like she wasn't treated in the first when she was making the first
was she?
Film.
That's nice. I like that.
They brought her on as a consultant, but apparently she's not in the movie. And I don't know how much. She might probably appear at the end of it for the next sequel, maybe. But I wonder if her absence will be felt. Now the mother's back in it, but then Linda Blair's
maybe.
Not back in it, majority of the film.
Maybe.
But we haven't seen the film yet, so that could just be press trying to keep her returning as a surprise. We'll wait and see.
Who knows? Exactly. We will see.
Exactly.
Mm.
So, taking that all into consideration, Claire, how many spinning head Reagans would you give The Exorcist out of five?
I'm going to give this movie 3 out of 5.
Ooh.
I think it's a very decent movie. It's very different from the first movie in terms of it's almost a different genre. They're both horrors, but in much like when we talked about the Jaws sequels, it's like each of them has a different genre within horror. You've got your thriller, there's a monster movie, there's a thriller, there's a slasher, and it's a bit like that with this. The Exorcist is almost a monster movie for me.
Yes.
And this is much more of the thriller.
Yes.
Version. And I like thrillers, so it works for me. It is a bit trippy. You do have to, there were a couple of moments where I stopped paying attention and came back to the movie and was like, what the fuck is going on? And I have to rewind and try and catch up with the film. And like I say, there were a couple of moments that I was paying attention and I still got lost. So it is a bit of a ride, but it works. And it's very clearly a sequel to the first movie. It links itself in, although the style is different, the first movie is integral to the second movie. You can't, we've talked before about, if you watch it as a standalone movie, it works, but as a sequel, it doesn't. Where with this movie, as a standalone, it kind of works, but actually you do need really to have seen the first movie to inform the second movie. So yeah, for me, it's a solid 3 out of 5. How about you?
So like I said before, I have a great history with this movie. It was the one I watched before The Exorcist. And like, what was it? 3 weeks ago, I was in Washington at the steps of The Exorcist and I went up to see the steps and I went to see the house in the original movie and
Did you?
Yes, it was it's worth going to see. Those stairs are steep. Like, when you get them, you walk up those stairs, you're just like, no wonder they kept breaking their neck, falling down.
Yeah.
These stairs. They are very steep stairs. Guys, if you haven't been, go. It's quite an experience. But for me, I would give it... Now, it was quite difficult to rate this film for me because over the every time I watch it, there's a little bit of me that dies inside because I have my, you know, maybe I should have watched it once and left it back in the early 90s when I originally watched it. But it's difficult for me because our previous episode, The Howling 2, I took in consideration the making of that and everything that went into involved in that, and I gave it 2.2. So I knew I couldn't come in less than that. So taking that into consideration, because this is a better film than The Howling 2, I've given The Exorcist 2 2.5.
It's extra 0.3 of a point.
Extra 3.3.
Absolutely.
And if I
critical.
Gave The Howling 2, if I looking back at it, if I really gave The Howling 2 1.5, this would be a 2. I really wanted to give this film a 2, but I couldn't because I've given
worse
movies.
But you can't score it lower than The Howling.
Basically, yeah. Sorry.
Fair enough. No, that's kind of makes sense. So that's Exorcist 2, The Heretic for you. Listeners, please take a moment to rate us and don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any new episodes. And tell us what you thought of the movie. You can leave us a comment, you can email us on unlovedsequels@gmail.com, and you can find us on all the socials at unlovedsequels.
So it's goodbye from me, Michael.
And from me, Claire.
Take care, guys. Bye.